I want to welcome everyone again. This is part 20, the final installment of 2,000 years, the Jewish Odyssey. Looking tonight at the 20th century, I want to thank again Becky and Avi Katz for their sponsorship, Yehuda Nishmas, Yona Ben Rav Aryeh Leib, and I want to thank all of you who came out, B'chol HaMazinim, all those listening on the CDs, for the very nice response. The 20th century is the most difficult of all the centuries to discuss because the material is infinite and the danger is real and unavoidable that I will omit or minimize critical events. We all live through a good part of it. Everyone here was actually born in the 20th century, an earth-shattering event in its own right. We all changed the world somehow. So I incorporate by reference the births of everyone here. But more to the point, our memories are very fresh of many of the events in the 20th century, and it's extremely difficult to reflect on something that we see up close in the Chofetz Chaim's parable of how we see God in history. He said it's like looking at a painting, an artistic masterpiece. If you go up close, it looks like globs of paint. It doesn't look like anything. But it's only at a distance that you see the broad strokes and how every dash fits together and how the masterpiece comes out. That's history as well. So until now, we had some perspective. We're able to look back at a distance of 100 or more years. But for the 20th century, we're still too close in time and we're still living through many of these events as well. So this is really a preliminary account. What are the events and trends of the 20th century that shape our lives today? How did we respond to all the movements of the 19th century, the yeshiva movement, the Musar movement, Zionism, socialism, communism, reform, the Enlightenment, etc.? What changes came about in Jewish life as a result of one of the greatest mass migrations in history until that point? 30 million people left Europe beginning in 1881, about 10% of them Jews going to the Western Hemisphere. And how did we weather the storm of the bloodiest century in human history, where easily well over 100 million people were murdered by tyrants, more than in all previous centuries combined? Last week, or 2 weeks ago, we discussed the end of the 19th century. We're speaking, of course, about the rise of Zionism. Herzl's vision animated Jewish life, and at the beginning of this century, the 20th century, it dominated Jewish discourse and energy. Not that it moved many people to become involved. Only 2% of the emigrants from Europe in the four decades of mass migration actually went to Eretz Yisrael. But every community spoke about it. It was an issue that roiled the Jewish world. Much had to be agreed upon, and naturally was not. Was the goal to be a Jewish state, a homeland, or a refuge? So a dispute immediately arose that would not be settled for decades between the political Zionists who wanted a state, Herzl, and the practical Zionists who wanted a homeland in which to settle Jews who needed a refuge from European persecution. Herzl pushed for a state. In 1902, he wrote a book called Alt-Neuland, The Old New Land, his vision of the reborn Jewish state. But when the prospects dimmed for any immediate relief in the land of Israel, Herzl embraced in 1903 the Uganda Plan, negotiating for Jewish colonial rights in British East Africa, what is today Kenya. It met with tremendous opposition from Chaim Weizmann, from Menachem Ussishkin, who succeeded Herzl as the head of the Zionist movement, from those who felt that Zionism without Zion was a bit lame. But Herzl wanted to show some progress after being rebuffed in every world capital, so he pushed for a vote, and he won a small plurality to form a committee to study the Uganda Plan. 295 for, 178 against, and 132 abstentions, most of whom were against the plan, but out of respect for Herzl, abstained. But Herzl died in the midst of a controversy with his leadership under severe attack at the young age of 44. When Herzl died, the Uganda plan died with him. Meanwhile, progress was being made. Already in 1901, the Jewish National Fund had been created to raise money to purchase land and settle land in Israel, and the practical Zionists then became ascendant. The JNF, from its inception, would raise money in blue and white pushkins that became standard in Jewish homes in Europe and then in America as well. Concomitant with the growth of agricultural settlements in the land of Israel came the revival of the Hebrew language, which really was a miracle, mostly through the work of Eliezer ben Yehuda. It was he, arriving in the 1880s, who insisted to his wife that they and their children speak only Hebrew in the home. No one else did. The common languages in Israel were German, Yiddish, and Arabic. It was he, Eliezer ben Yehuda, who set about modernizing a language that had not been common usage for almost 2,000 years. And it was he who insisted on the Sephardic pronunciation that became prevalent in Israel and later across the Jewish world as well. In addition to the farming communities, the first all-Jewish city, Tel Aviv, was founded in 1909. It's celebrating its centennial this year. And also in 1909, the first kibbutz, the Ganya, near the Kinneret, was started. It was a tribute to the socialist founders who wanted to create the socialist paradise in the land of Israel. But in truth, if you ask me, the kibbutz movement's a little overrated. The work was difficult then, of course. Many left the kibbutz shortly after it was founded. Some persevered, but the mythology of the kibbutz is a staple of Israeli life. On the positive side, it fostered a sense of cooperation and self-sacrifice. On the negative side, as we know, it separated parents from children. By and large, it kept the Torah outside the gates of the kibbutz and essentially indoctrinated them in a philosophy of life that was antithetical to human nature and therefore ultimately rejected in the latter half, certainly the latter third of the 20th century. All this was occurring as Russia was again exploding with a pogrom in Kishinev in April 1903 that shocked the world. Even if, by later standards, it was mild, fewer than 50 Jews were killed, in the Kishinev pogrom, the pogrom prompted by the discovery of the body of a murdered Christian on Easter Sunday, shades of a medieval past that Russia never really outgrew. But it prompted Jews in Russia to go to Israel by the tens of thousands, as did the Russo-Japanese War, which Russia was defeated. That was followed by anti-government riots in which Jewish agitators played an important role. That second Aliyah, the so-called second Aliyah, after the pogrom in Kishinev and with all the problems in Russia, brought a wave of Jewish socialists to Israel for the first time that transformed the society. Religious Jews had a mixed response to Zionism. There were some avid supporters, there were some curious onlookers, but most were bitter antagonists. In 1902, Rav Yaakov Reines, the Rav in Lida, head of the yeshiva in Lida as well, Lithuania, founded Mizrahi, the movement of religious Zionists, which became part of the Zionist establishment. That evoked tremendous opposition in the religious world. Rav Reines was adamant that his course was correct, and he didn't shrink from dressing down his rabbinical colleagues. So he and Mizrahi were always part of the Zionist movement, but of course in the minority. Other Rabbonim were not supportive. Herzl wrote in his diary, very insightful comment. He wrote, "It will always be one of the great curiosities of our period that rabbis should be praying for Zion and working against it." It was truth to what he wrote, but perhaps it should have been no surprise. Once the Rabbonim lost control of the movement in the 1890s, and especially when the Zionist movement took on an overt anti-Torah complexion, it didn't help that many of the old-time maskilim had embraced Zionism as their newest and latest hope for a better world, if cooperation then with the rabbinical establishment was possible in the 1890s, by the 1900s, those days were gone. Given the nature of the secular Zionist movement, the lack of Torah commitment, even hostility of many of the leaders, the overt statement of some that Zionism is designed to replace the Torah, and the fear in the religious world of all new isms born of the turmoil of the 19th century, so it's no surprise that the opposition was widespread and intense, if not monolithic. The ideological opponents were mainly Hungarian-based, Munkács, Szatmár, etc. The groups that posited that a Jewish state was impossible before Yemos HaMashiach, and the desire for one was rooted in heresy and rebellion. So they preferred national passivity, do nothing, and they rested their case in large part on the three oaths, the Gimel Shavuos in Maseches Ksuvos of Kufir Aleph Amar Aleph, one of which admonished Jews not to rise up in force and conquer the land of Israel, Shelo Yalu Bachoma. But theirs was always a minority opinion. Most of the Gedolim were practical opponents of Zionism, staunch, to be sure, but practical in the sense that a different movement with different leaders and ideology might have won their support. It is not that they opposed the Jewish state as much as they opposed the Jewish state led by heretics who openly mocked the Torah. In this group we found, therefore, almost all the rabbinical leaders and Rosh Yeshiva of the time, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, Reb Chafetz Chaim, etc., and Telz, and Meir, and Slobodka, across the board, it was a rejection of secular Zionism. To cement this opposition, in 1912, in Katowice, Poland, Agudat Israel was formed as an organization that brought together all of Torah Jewry opposing secular Zionism and popularizing thereafter for the remainder of the century until today the notion of Das Torah, that official rabbinic opinion on public affairs has the same weight as rabbinic opinion in Psak Halacha. But there are two different types of oppositions, the philosophical and the practical. After 1948, the practical opponents of Zionism almost completely faded out. So when people speak today of Agudat Yisrael as anti-Zionist, it's a mistake. They're not anti-Zionist, they're non-Zionist. The only people who remained anti-Zionist were the philosophical opponents, like the Szatmár and the Munkács and other Hungarian Jewish communities. In Israel itself, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonenfeld, who was an opponent, a very vociferous opponent of secular Zionism, became the head of the old Yishuv in 1919, 10 years after the death of Rabbi Shmuel Salant, who had headed the Jewish community for over 50 years. He wasn't appointed immediately to succeed Rabbi Shmuel Salant, even though he was the gadol of the time, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonenfeld, for a very understandable reason. He was a Hungarian, and the voters were all Lithuanians, and they could not tolerate the notion that a Hungarian would be head of the Jewish community in Yerushalayim. I see someone shaking his head, you understand. The problem was that it was during that decade, from 1909 to 1919, there was tremendous turbulence, and the old Yishuv lacked a leader, and they paid a terrible price for it. There were secular opponents to Zionism also, mainly members of the Bund, in America became known as the Workman's Circle, a band of socialists who would change the world and make it safe for Jews. Didn't quite turn out that way. In any event, with Herzl's demise, the focus became settlement and building, and plans for a political state were placed on the back burner for about 15 years or so. The Torah world was transformed in the 20th century in a remarkable way. The temptation exists just to list the Gedolim who are familiar to us, but there's a context, in fact two contexts, that should not be lost. Firstly, the 20th century was a time mostly a time not of original Torah works or Torah thinkers. Oh, there are a number of exceptions, but it was a century of encyclopedic works. that sustain us until today. It's a different focus than existed, say, in the 18th or 15th centuries. It really started in the 19th century. Reb Shlomo Gottfried published the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, the Aruch HaShulchan of Reb Chaim Michael Epstein of Novardvuk, who died in 1908. He was the brother-in-law of the Netziv. So the Aruch HaShulchan was a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch on all the halakim of the Shulchan Aruch, all four halakim. Then he took it to the next level and supplemented it with Aruch HaShulchan or Aruch HaShulchan HaAsid, the future Aruch HaShulchan, all the halachas that are not now relevant and therefore mostly not in the Shulchan Aruch, but will be in the future. Peah, Paraduma, Tumatahara, etc. His son, Baruch HaLevi Epstein, the Tar Tanima, 1860 to 1942, was a banker by profession, wrote the famous commentary on the Torah that lists, sequentially, all the statements of Chazal on every pasuk, again showing the unity of the Tershid Chassav, Tershid Alpeh. In Eretz Yisrael, the Zdechemed, Reb Chaim Chizkiya Medini of Hebron, died 1904, wrote another super commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. The Reb Yosef Chaim Al-Hakam, the Ben Ish Chai, died 1909 in Baghdad, one of the most prolific Torah giants of the Sephardic world. And the aforementioned Chafetz Chaim, who wrote when he was in his 30s his eponymous work on Lashon Hara, but completed the Mishnah Berurah in 1907. Every Sefer needs Mazel. That became the classic work on Aruch Chaim, on which we depend until today. The modernization of communication contributed to another lasting development in Jewish life, the rise of the Tshuvos. Of course, we know already this dated back to the Tshuvos HaGaonim, but with the telegraph and then the telephone, the usage and effect of tshuvos increased exponentially. The Gedolei Hador were no longer isolated and inaccessible, but could be contacted from across the globe with relative ease. So this added to the prominence of the outstanding leader towards the end of the 19th century, Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector of Kovna. He died 1896, acknowledged Gadol Hador. In a generation, you know, that had the Chafetz Chaim and had the Reb Chaim Brisky, he was acknowledged Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan as the Gadol Hador. And of course, we saw an explosion of this in the latter half of the century. Reb Moshe Feinstein, who died in 1986, and in Eretz Yisrael, both of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who died in 1995, the first child to be born in the Shari Chesed David of Yerushalayim, and the Bala Mechaim L'Chaim Rav Avadi Yasef, and literally dozens of others. From the Tshuvos, as always, we can place ourselves in the context of the times. Many of them are world famous, deserve to be studied today, both for their halachic structure and their historical value. Famous Tshuva from the 1920s, permitting the consumption of Coca-Cola. I have that one in the office. Ramosha's leniency, permitting commercial milk to be used, and literally hundreds of others. I said it was a century that did not have that many original Torah thinkers. There were exceptions. Several figures stand out. First and foremost, Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, 1865 to 1935, learned for a short time in Volozhin, made Aliyah in 1904, actually came to Eretz Yisrael, Chof Ches Iyar, it's on his tombstone, today it's Yom Yerushalayim, came Chof Ches Iyar 1904, becoming the Rav of Yafo and the Moshavot. Rav Kuk sensed, that's why he made Aliyah, the immediate end of the Golos, and he demonstrated how the new Jew, with a healthy body and soul, would be able to revive Jewish national life and enable us to take our place among the world of nations and fulfill the role that God ordained for us, but that had been dormant for so long. Rav Kook's works, written a poetic, abstruse Hebrew that few people fully understand, are classics, and his brilliant mind overflowed with ideas and with the life of the soul. His son, Reb Tzvi Yehuda, testified that when his father would write, he would write. He would write chapters on end without making a single emendation to what he'd written. as if it's coming from his soul. So his manuscripts became his books without any editing at all. He, Rav Kook, would play a huge role in the development of pre-state Israel as the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi, and of course later his son, in the 70s, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kohen Kook, would spearhead the Gush Emunim movement that led to the settlement of the territories after the Six-Day War. Another original thinker, more familiar to us, Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, 1903-1993, spoke the language of modern America and showed how a Jew could be at home, if not completely comfortable, in the modern world and the world of Torah. So it was that balance, the fidelity to halacha, and the openness to intellectual trends in the world at large that shaped several generations of modern Orthodox American Jews, especially as the Rav personally ordained more than 1,000 rabbis. Unlike Rav Kook, the Rav's writings are relatively sparse. He's written a lot more since he died than he ever did while he was alive. But like Rav Kook, his presence was centered in a yeshiva. Rav Kook, at the Merkaz HaYeshiva Olami, that he founded in Yerushalayim, now known simply as Merkaz HaRav, and for the Rav, Yeshiva University, or Reitz, named after Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, that traced its origin to its Chaim Yeshiva in 1886 on the Lower East Side, and really came into its own when Rabbi Dov Revel became president in 1915, and of course found its permanent place on the map when the Rav succeeded his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, as Rosh Yeshiva in 1941. Agav Urcha, there was a struggle over the succession, and an interesting tidbit, the student newspaper, The Commentator, editorialized against the Rav's appointment, saying that because he was a member of Agudas HaRabbonim, he's unfit to teach at Yeshiva University. Fortunately, they were not listened to. Another thinker, Rabbi Yitzhak Huttner, 1906 to 1980, prolific writer as well, the Pachad Yitzhak, became a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshivas Chaim Berlin, also built a bridge between the traditional and modern world, but not as much as the others did. And across the pond, Rabbi Eliyahu Detzler, 1892 to 1953, brought the Musa world into the 20th century at Gateshead, and then at the Panovich Yeshiva in Bnei Brak. And of course, in Bnei Brak, the Chazon Ish, Rabbi Shai Karelitz, 1878 to 1953, was instrumental in building that into a Torah center. Apropos of Torah in the 20th century, and it's the encyclopedic nature of its works, we saw the proliferation of Sifrei Halacha on every topic under the sun, major and minor, such that has not existed since the beginning of time. Books on Shabbos and Kashrus and Sfiras Omer and Ribbis and Ergin and Yom Tovim and Shiloh HaKein, Avelus and Ksuba and Nisuin, whatever topic now has a book, a full-length volume that incorporates every possible opinion that is mentioned on that particular topic. It's one of the amusing sidebars to rabbinic life. You take, for example, a sif in Shulchan Aruch. There's one sif that talks about the Avelus on Sfiras Omer, and yet I have a two-volume work that elucidates that one sif about Avelus during Sfiras Omer. With that came another development post-war, the phenomenon known to us as satisfying every opinion. Sak Halacha waned, and as the level of observance increased, especially the last few decades, a tendency arose not to determine what the halachic consensus was, but rather to accommodate the most exclusive or comprehensive opinion. But for most of the century, the notion that that would be the thrust of halachic decision-making at the end of the century would have been a pipe dream. The 20th century was the American century for the world and for Jews, as for most of the century, America was the world center of Jewry, especially after the Holocaust. Millions of Jews arrived in the United States beginning in the 1880s, such that within a decade, there were already more than 200 shuls in New York City, most of whom did not get along. The transition from Europe to America was not an easy one. Even in America, it wasn't easy. It was a clash of cultures between the earlier German Jewish settlers, who literally looked down on the newcomers from their perch on the Upper East Side to the Lower East Side. And as the immigrants were not the most learned Jews or the most observant Jews, it was quite common for observance of mitzvos to be gradually or quickly abandoned, often for economic reasons. They felt they had to work on Shabbos, often they did, and sometimes merely to dispense with the baggage of the old world. Many, or if not most, were not religious. And of those who were, it became nearly impossible to keep their children religious. So a whole generation reared on Shvertz Zayin Yid, it's hard to be a Jew, and they believed it. And so they abandoned it for greener pastures. There was an attempt to create the infrastructure of Jewish life, shuls, yeshivas, mikvos, etc. Questions, for example, about the permissibility of an Erev in Manhattan go back 100 years, but this infrastructure met with tremendous opposition. And the freedoms of America mitigated the authority of the rabbis who came. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, for example, known to us as RJJ, came from Russia, was appointed the chief rabbi of New York, but he fell ill, never really accomplished that much. Great rabbanim came and had few people to learn with or even to talk to. The RCA printed, the RCA disseminated a few years ago on a CD-ROM, Sfarim, written by tremendous Talmidei Chachamim, who served in small towns across America and had no one to talk to. They were just right. So I have all the Sfarim on a CD-ROM as well. Reb Chaim Vidrowitz came and appointed himself the chief rabbi of America. So he was asked, who made him the chief rabbi? So he said, the sign painter, because that was a shingle outside his office. So someone said to him, all America? So he said, yes, it will be impossible for American Jewry to unite and depose me. So therefore, chief rabbi of America. Such was the chaos in Jewish life, especially in Kashrus, and every community structure was very difficult to sustain. It was an uphill battle to build Torah in America. One reason why many religious Jews declined even to come to the Treif of Medina. And of those who did, no less the persons in the Chafetz Chaim pleaded with them for their children's survival to come back to Europe. In the early part of the century, America became a very hospitable climate for the founding of what was called conservative Judaism, which became all the rage, an attempt to influence the immigrants to be both good Jews and good Americans by conforming halacha to the needs of modern life. They're able to do this because most of the founders were ex-maskilim, like Salman Schachter, for example, and they belonged to the so-called historical school of Judaism that we discussed last time, that did not fully subscribe to Torah ben Hashamayim, but was more identified with the ideas of the Frankel Seminary in Breslau. Conservative Judaism had a long run, but infidelity to halacha cannot long sustain itself. Like Reform Judaism, there are very few multi-generation conservative Jewish families, and by the end of the century, it was ideological indistinguishable from Reform Judaism. Shortly after its founding, they created their own seminary, Jewish Theological Seminary, founded actually in 1886, in which what we would call today some religious Orthodox Jews involved with as well. It was on their watch that they did away with the mechitza as a staple of shuls, even though on their premises, the mechitza and the seminary exists until today. Although in the 90s, they did establish a separate non-mechitza minyan. The mechitza became the major issue in synagogue life. In 1949, with the move to suburbia, a conservative responsum permitted, listen carefully, riding in a car to shul, although not driving. But that was a distinction that was lost on the readers, many of whom, as we know, some of it I've actually seen, would drop off their children at the temple in the morning and then go to the mall to shop. The difference between driving and riding was lost on them. Trying to bridge the gap, the National Council of Young Israel was founded in 1912 to serve as a meeting point for young Jews in shuls that would have mechitzos, whose rabbis would all speak English, and whose officers would all be Shomrei Shabbos. That's all in the Young Israel Constitution. By contrast, the Orthodox Union, founded in 1898, ironically by some of the founders of JTS also, had many member shuls without mechitzos, and they only formally broke with the JTS after the Shabbos decision in 1949. The OU began its kashra supervision in the 1920s. First company under the Hashkacha?
Heinz.
Very good. And the rest is history. Jews were also prominent in the labor union movement and in philanthropy across America. Secular institutions, museums, hospitals, etc. And in a number of industries, especially entertainment, where it is argued persuasively that Jews invented Hollywood. And the community grew in prosperity and acceptance until Irving Kristol noted in the 1970s that the main problem in American Jewish life is not that non-Jews want to kill Jews, but that non-Jews want to marry Jews. And that was a major departure from the traditional trajectory of exile. Sounds all very good, you know, difficult, challenging, but mostly positive. All this took place against the backdrop of world events that shattered Jewish life, left the Jewish people reeling after an escalation of Jew hatred that culminated in an unprecedented orgy of brutality and hatred. 20th century, just looking at till now, what I've said seems very innocuous, until we reflect on the fact that the isms of the 19th century unleashed passions that were barbaric. In some of the countries, it was more of the same. Mendel Bayliss, for example, was arrested in Kiev in 1911 on blood libel charges that were preposterous. Nonetheless, the Russian press filled with Jew baiting. There was international condemnation of the Russians, and after spending 2 years in prison, Bayliss was acquitted in 1913. Leo Frank wasn't as fortunate. He was arrested and convicted in Atlanta, Georgia in 1914 on falsified evidence of the murder of a teenage girl who worked in his factory. He was sentenced to death. When his sentence was commuted to life imprisonment, he was taken from jail by the local Georgians and lynched to death, the only Jew ever lynched in America. World War I began on Tisha B'Av in 1914 and brought havoc to Jewish life. The carnage in Europe was shocking, with new weapons making their appearance, like machine guns, tanks, aircraft, all making a macabre debut. Jews fought on both sides in World War I. The yeshuv in Israel nearly collapsed from starvation. There was a net loss in population in the 1910s. Jewish communities in Eastern Europe were all dislocated. Every yeshiva had to flee. The great Rosh Yeshiva spent the war years outside of their homes, without permanent access to the yeshivos. By coincidence, Rav Kook had traveled to Europe in July 1914, and he was unable to return to Israel for 5 years. Israel being under the control of the Ottomans, an enemy of the British, he had spent his years first in Switzerland, then London. He became the Rav of a shul, Machzike Hadas, in London. But the end of the war saw a new world order. The old empires were all gone. The Kaiser was gone. The Tsar was gone. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was gone. And the Ottoman Empire was gone. General Edmund Allenby liberated Yerushalayim in December 1917, ending Muslim rule in Israel that had lasted almost 700 years. Just a few weeks earlier, the Balfour Declaration had been issued on November 2nd, rewarding Jews for their support of the British war effort. Jews had their own legion that joined in the fighting, the Zion Mule Corps. Chaim Weizmann especially was instrumental in the issuance of the Balfour Declaration, he had warmed himself to the British authorities. He's a chemist. Weizmann developed the acetone that refined the explosive capability of shells, made British shells much more lethal. The Balfour Declaration committed the British government to facilitating a Jewish homeland in Israel as long as, I quote, the civil and religious rights of the native population are not prejudiced thereby. Well, no problem on that account. That contradiction, that there could be a Jewish homeland on the one hand, as long as it did not prejudice the rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in the land, would haunt the next 90 years, even though no less a personage than the Emir Faisal of Syria, than Iraq, met Weizmann in 1920 and wrote that he wished the Jews, I quote, a most hearty welcome home. The welcome didn't last. Two consequences. The Zionist mantra that we're settling a land without a people for a people without a land proved false. There were people there, but most Arabs, in fact, came in a wave of immigration in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s, exploiting the Jews' economic development of the land. Most of the Arabs were not there from time immemorial. Most came from surrounding countries. For every Jew who came, two Arabs came. That's why there was disparity in 1948 and thereafter. Jewish immigration was limited from 1921 on, but never Arab immigration. And in any event, the map of the Middle East was being redrawn by the British and the French with consequence until today. They literally created countries on the map. Iraq, Iran, Transjordan, Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, into North Africa as well. 1920 also saw the beginning of Arab nationalism, so-called Arab nationalism, with anti-Jewish riots in Yerushalayim in the north, where Trumpeldor was killed at Tel Chai. But Arab nationalism would almost only concentrate on thwarting the Jews, never on building anything Arab. Balfour Day, by contrast, was celebrated by many Jews. You know, some Jews opposed the Balfour Declaration. One famous member of parliament, Edwin Montagu, opposed it because he felt it cast doubt on their loyalty to Britain if they're set to have another homeland. The great Bar Sameach of Simcha Cohen, Mayor Simcha Cohen of Dvinsk, saw the Balfour Declaration as the permission of the nations of the world that thereby obviated the problem of the Gimel Shvuos of Shelo Yalu Bechomo. So that could have done away with the philosophical opposition to Zionism. But, of course, it didn't. Once you oppose something, it's very hard to retract. In any event, darker days were ahead. The old Yishuv protested its marginalization. They tried to set up its own organization to negotiate with the British. That ended in 1923 when its spokesman, Yaakov Dahan, was murdered. The hit ordered, documents later revealed, by Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, who would become Israel's second president, the first of several political assassinations that would rock the Jewish world in the 20th century. Also in 1920, the Histadrut was formed, a union, but more than that, Histadrut provided a power base for a rival of Chaim Weizmann named David Ben-Gurion. David Ben-Gurion, 1886 to 1973, and he would soon take over the leadership of the Zionist movement as something very ingenious. The Histadrut was not just a labor union. They founded a food cooperative, Tnuva, a bank, Bank HaPoalim, a healthcare system, Kupat Cholim, an army, the Haganah, the framework of a governing entity. So right away there was an infrastructure that he had that could dominate the society and could win support. You wanted healthcare, you wanted banking, become a member of Histadrut. You want inexpensive food, go to the Tnuva, open to members, not open to non-members. And that's how he gained power. Zev Jabotinsky, his great rival, the assimilated Russian writer turned Zionist militant and proud Jew, broke with the Zionist movement over their acquiescence to British immigration restrictions, their acquiescence to the fact that in the early 20s, Churchill severed 75-80% of historic Palestine and gave it to the Arabs, Transjordan. He objected to all that. In 1925, He started the revisionist Zionist movement, non-socialists. Jabotinsky became both a hero and a pariah, depending on one's politics, and his movement would challenge, threaten, and be persecuted by the left for the remainder of the century. World War I left Germany weakened and leaderless and embarrassed and impoverished. They were to be demilitarized, the Germans. Beware of guarantees of demilitarization, by the way. They were to be deprived of the riches of the Alsace and the Rhineland. They had to suffer the ignominy of a reborn Poland, which nobody should have to suffer. When the economy of the Weimar Republic crumbled in the 1920s, and again after the stock market crash in 1929, it didn't take long for many of the rabble-rousers to point fingers at the Jews. Adolf Hitler, 1889 to 1945, a native of Linz, Austria, a failed artist and house painter, perceived the Jews as the scapegoats for the failures of Germany. When an attempted coup against the Munich city government failed in 1923, Hitler spent 9 months in prison, where he wrote Mein Kampf, My Struggle, a work remarkable in the sense that Hitler spelled out in detail everything he planned on doing some 15 years before he started doing it. It was a bestseller. Hitler sold 240,000 copies of his book in the next 10 years. After that, it became mandatory reading, so millions were sold. His National Socialist Party, Nazi Party, slowly gained popularity, becoming the largest party in Germany in 1930, and enabling Hitler to become chancellor on January 30th, 1933. He effectively disbanded the Reichstag. It burned down, coincidentally, a month after he took power. He began enacting anti-Jewish measures like the Nuremberg Laws that stripped Jews of basic rights, that won wide popular support in Germany. He began rearming, he remilitarized the Rhineland, incrementally testing Europe's resolve, which was essentially non-existent. Agavurcha, not that much different from today. Claiming the need for a Lebensraum, living room, living space, Hitler took the Sudetenland in 1938 and was given Czechoslovakia a year later, each time weighing carefully each move based on the response of Britain and France. War, for which Hitler had prepared but the Allies had not, was near. One could argue cogently that Hitler's main goal in starting World War II was to exterminate the Jews, that he dreamt of world conquest, because that's how he'd be able to murder the Jewish people. Hitler's Jew hatred was racially based, arguably an offshoot of social Darwinism, to which Nazi literature made reference. Natural selection, or survival of the fittest, presupposed that some lives were worthless, even harmful to the survival of the species, and Jews were at the top of that list. The first concentration camp was set up already in 1933, just after Hitler took power, in Dachau, outside of Munich, with others to follow, and there Hitler incarcerated political prisoners and Jews as well. But after Hitler invaded Poland on September 1st, 1939, his Jew-killing machine went into full gear, first liquidating Jews in a haphazard fashion wherever he found them, later through the use of the Einsatzgruppen killing squads and mobile gas chambers as the Germans marauded through the Soviet Union, and finally after the Wannsee Conference in 1942 in the suburb of Berlin that deliberated the so-called final solution to the Jewish problem through the establishment of six extermination centers, all in Poland, Auschwitz-Birkenau, Treblinka, Majdanek, Chełmno, Sobibor, and Belzec. After hoarding the Jews into hundreds of ghettos where they would be worked and starved and stripped of their humanity and become easy prey for the Nazi killing machine. It was a ghastly marriage of modern technology and organization to the most primitive hatred and ruthlessness known to mankind. Hitler murdered almost 6 million Jews perhaps 17 million civilians in all, in a war that claimed tens of millions of lives in all. Interestingly, most of the genocides of the 20th century were local. Stalin murdered 40, 50 million of his own people, mainly some of them Jews also, but Mao killed perhaps 100 million Chinese. Most were local. The Holocaust was not. By war's end, a third of the Jewish people had been murdered. From a pre-war population of 18 million, the most ever that we had, the Jewish population was reduced to 12 million and continued to fall still further as the war was followed by a wave of assimilation and rejection. It's likely that Jews will never again reach that high point of 18 million souls until Yemos HaMashiach. Jews were largely unprepared for the Holocaust. Few saw the handwriting on the wall, most did not leave, but who could anticipate the unprecedented butchery? Whole communities were destroyed. The Jews of Lithuania essentially ceased to exist. Of 3.3 million Polish Jews, 3 million Jews were killed. The whole families, villages, towns were eliminated from existence, such that even Yad Vashem today has the names of only a little more than half of the victims. Many had no survivors and no voice. Jews did collaborate to some extent, in some cases, in their destruction, with the Judenrats, the Jewish councils, and many ghettos doing the work the Nazis would have found difficult to do on their own. Some Jews saved themselves by becoming kapos in the concentration camps, not always successfully. There was physical resistance in many places, the Warsaw Ghetto, in Treblinka, in Sobibor, in Auschwitz also, but with a negligible effect on the ultimate outcome. And there was inspiring spiritual resistance as well, with Jews faithful to Torah and mitzvos, and knowingly dying al kiddush Hashem. But there was little unity. Zionists tried to save Zionists, rabbis tried to save rabbis, the Varatzola, a few hardy souls, Jews and non-Jews, tried to save Jewish life regardless. Almost all the Jews, for example, of both Bulgaria and Denmark were saved because of the personal intervention of the kings in both countries. But their efforts of all these brave souls were only marginally effective. I always say, if you walk on the Avenue of the Righteous Gentiles, where a tree was planted to honor the memory of the righteous Gentiles who saved Jews, if you walk there on a sunny day, it doesn't provide that much shade. It's not taking anything away from those Giborim who reached out and defied the Nazis and saved Jews, but nonetheless, the story of the Holocaust is a story of a disaster. It's not the story of survival. American Jews were slow to react when they reacted at all. Franklin Roosevelt was a hero to Jews, only later learned that he also was perfidious during the war, didn't lift a finger to save Jews. American Jews knew of the extermination in 1942. By the end of 1942, 3 million of 6 million Jews had already been killed, and America knew about it. American Jews knew about it. But a war refugee board was not established until January 1944, and even then it wasn't that effective. The horror was too great to bear. Some just didn't believe it. But rational thinking was uncommon, and therefore Jews were silent for nearly two decades after, trying to come to grips with what had occurred. Now, 70 years after World War II began, it's still difficult for us to assess the losses to Jewish life, 1,000 years of European Jewish history. The noble, the lofty, and the pedestrian, giants of Torah, beacons of culture, all gone. It's hard to accept. Were Jews disabused of the high-sounding movements of brotherhood and socialism and world peace? Surprisingly not. It only took 30, 40 years and Jews started to move back even to Germany. Germany had the highest rate of increase in Jewish population of any country outside of Israel in the 1990s. It's the Jews soured on Yom Kippur for a time. There's a pogrom in Kielce, Poland, July 4th, 1946, a little over a year after the war ended, that killed 42 Jews. So at least for a time, Jews saw that Europe was finished as a haven. But even Europe would have a rebirth at the end of the century. Less than 5 million European Jews survived World War II, 3 million of them becoming what was tantamount to prisoners in the Soviet Union, and they were almost murdered by a plot of a mad Joseph Stalin in 1953, aborted only by Stalin's death on the eve of Purim that year. Several hundred thousand survivors came to America after the war, won refuge in the beginning of the war, rescued by the Vadat Solo, who became active in the relief efforts, was Rav Aaron Cutler, 1891 to 1962, who in 1943 founded a yeshiva in the rural town of Lakewood, New Jersey, trying to recreate the yeshiva experience of Europe. He started with 14 boys. He hoped, he said, to get a maximum of 50 students. Today, of course, Lakewood boasts thousands of Talmidim. Rav Aaron Cutler was also instrumental in creating Torah Mesorah, a network of day schools that changed Jewish education. And the efforts of some before the war, like the Shraga Feivel Mendelowitz of Torah V'Das, bore fruit after the war with an influx of religious Jews that revitalized Jewish life, such that within two decades, the tide had turned and orthodoxy that had seemed in the 20s and 30s to be a moribund, dying movement came to prominence in the 60s and especially the 70s and 80s, the 60s being an era in the U.S. generally of ethnic assertiveness. No longer was the melting pot an aspiration, and public school the vehicle to a Jew's assimilation. Jews, like other ethnic groups, took pride in our heritage with yeshiva education and Hebrew names, an abundance of kosher food, laws protecting Shmirah Shabbos, a greater cultural awareness across America of Jewish life, and Jews in public life. For the first time in American Jewish life, Orthodox Jews moved to the front seat of the car, while the Reform and Conservative movements struggled to retain their members, utilizing gimmicks like women rabbis of patrilineal descent, or the welcoming of intermarried couples just to boost their numbers. Intermarriage from the 50s to the 90s skyrocketed from single digits to today more than 50% of the Jewish population. If you crunch the numbers, it means it's more than 70% of the non-Orthodox population. Well over a majority of non-Orthodox Jews marry non-Jews. For much of American Jewry, the Holocaust replaced the Torah as the substance of Jewish life, and memorialization of the Holocaust became a, if not the, major indicator of Jewish identity, more than mitzvahs. Billions of dollars were spent combating a non-existent Jew hatred. America, of course, still is. Many Jews focus on the need for the Jewish people to survive without ever articulating or even contemplating precisely why it is important that the Jewish people survive. But a new assertiveness did enter Jewish life, and the Jewish world was divided into two groups, those who do and those who don't. And with those who don't, still claiming a full and equal share in the fate of the Jewish people. For many years, Jews united over one issue, and that was the State of Israel. The fate of European Jewry was sealed when the British imposed severe restrictions on Jewish immigration with a white paper in 1939, permitting a total of 75,000 Jews to be admitted over the next 5 years, and then that was it. Coupled with American immigration quotas dating from the 20s, quotas that incidentally went unfilled in the 30s and 40s, Europe's Jews had nowhere to go. Arab violence in the 30s had engendered the founding of the Irgun Tzvei Lumi, a militant group under Jabotinsky's authority that rejected the Haganah's policy of Havlagah, restraint, of not responding to Arab provocation. The Irgun did respond. When the Irgun decided to suspend its anti-British operations with the start of World War II, a splinter group broke away from the Irgun, known as Lochamei Chirut Yisrael, Lehi, derisively called the Stern Gang, after its founder, Avram Stern. Stern was gunned down by the British in 1942, but soon after the Holocaust ended, the drive for independence began in earnest. All three Jewish fighting forces combined for a time, sporadically. At other times, the Haganah turned on the Irgun, betraying them to the British, hunting them down during the Saison, even denying their complicity in joint attacks, like the bombing of the King David Hotel, part of which was British mandatory headquarters, where the Haganah left the Irgun out to dry. By 1947, the British had tired of the mandate given them by the defunct League of Nations and turned over responsibility to the new United Nations, which issued a resolution partitioning the land of Israel into an Arab and Jewish state when the mandate would end May 14, 1948. The Arabs rejected partition, the Jews accepted it, some with wild rejoicing, others with a heavy heart. Partition, the map of partition, would have deprived the Jewish people of Yerushalayim, that was to be internationalized, and left Israel with a sliver of land along the coast, a little in the north, most of their land in the uninhabitable Negev desert. For months, the two sides jockeyed militarily back and forth. On May 14, 1948, despite heavy pressure from the U.S. not to declare statehood, Ben-Gurion proclaimed the reestablishment of the Jewish state in the land of Israel to be called Medinat Yisrael. It was, on his part, a courageous and controversial act. In an instant, the Jewish people ended almost 19 centuries of exile, an exile in which Jews have suffered tremendously and yet also spread the Jewish idea across the globe. Within several years, the population of Israel doubled due to the influx of Jews, mainly refugees forced to flee Arab lands, but from other countries as well, as the Kibbutz Golia took place, aided as well by the law of return that granted immediate citizenship to all Jews anywhere in the world as soon as they came to Israel. Religious life was again rebuilt after the Holocaust, like after the other catastrophes in Jewish history. In 1947, Ben-Gurion negotiated what was called the status quo agreement with Agudat Yisrael. There'll be official kashrus and Shabbos in the government. The Rabbanut would control Yishut, marriage and divorce, and there'd be Chinuch, Torah, religious education as well. That's the status quo agreements referred to until today, even though over the decades it's being whittled down more and more. During the War of Independence, Israel expanded its territory in a brutal war that claimed the lives of 1% of the Jewish population, which in war is an enormous toll. But it was the first time since Bar Kokhba that a Jewish army had risen in the land of Israel in defense of Jews. With the borders of the new country somewhat defined by the Armistice Agreement in 1949, but without permanent acceptance by the Arab world, Israel began immediately its long and never-ending quest for peace. After years of terrorist incursions from Jordanian-occupied Judean Samaria and Egyptian-occupied Gaza, Israel invaded Sinai in 1956, with British and French participation, conquered the Sinai, but was forced to surrender it in 1957 by an angry President Eisenhower. The same pattern recurred, along with attacks on the northern border from Syria, and Arab threats of extermination induced Israel to launch a preemptive strike in June 1967 against Egypt and Syria, and then Jordan too, when Jordan entered the conflict. In just 6 days, Israel captured, tripled its territory, captured Sinai, Judea, Samaria, and Gaza, the Golan Heights, and most movingly, the old city of Yerushalayim, which came under Jewish sovereignty for the first time since the Churban. It was a new world. The return to biblical Israel unleashed pent-up feelings of pride. The settlement movement began, and dissipated fears of destruction. The Six-Day War, you can trace it back even earlier, the trial, conviction, and execution of Adolf Eichmann, the mastermind of the Final Solution, another native of Linz, Austria. Both those events, the Eichmann trial and the Six-Day War, allowed Jews to speak more freely about the Holocaust. Jews were victors, no longer victims, but it was a crown that we did not wear well or easily. Again, the peace train rumbled on. Israel immediately offered to return all the territories it had conquered in exchange for peace, but the offer was spurned. Instead, Egypt and Syria attacked on Yom Kippur 1973, advancing into Sinai and through the Golan until being repulsed, with Israel advancing into Syria and Egypt. This commenced the ongoing pressure led by the then American Jewish Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, a German Jewish refugee, for Israel to gradually withdraw from territory, which it did, and for the onus thereafter always to be on Israel to make tangible concessions in exchange for words. That pattern, of course, endures until today, with the crux of UN Resolution 242 after the Six-Day War mandating that Israel withdraw from territories occupied in the recent conflict, but not all the territories. That's essentially forgotten. Bear in mind, the PLO was founded in 1964, 3 years before Israel captured Judea and Samaria and began its career of killing innocent civilians with a spate of plane hijackings and later with steady but spectacular acts of terror. Yasser Arafat's name was associated with butchery until Jews tried to rehabilitate him in the 1990s. Over time, this unfortunately whittled away at Israel's confidence and the West's support for Israel, and even its residual guilt over the Holocaust, such that Israel, always riding the peace train, was slowly strangled into more and more concessions. At Camp David, 1978, Menachem Begin agreed to return all of Sinai to Egypt and to recognize what was called the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people, a people whose very existence had been denied by Prime Minister Golda Meir just a few years earlier. Begin in Camp David granted autonomy to the Palestinians. They never accepted, but the die was cast. And since then, the concessions have been assumed with only the pace to be negotiated. With that, and especially after the Oslo Accords in 1994 gave Israel the fantasy of peace, Israel's security position was compromised to its present state of vulnerability. The Oslo Agreement, negotiated in secret and in violation of Israeli law, let loose a reign of terror such as Israel had never seen in its history. For the first time, its cities and towns were under siege. Society was completely divided. One tragic victim was the Prime Minister Rabin, who was assassinated. But the appropriate lessons regarding the feasibility of peace had not been drawn. Aside from the aliyah of the Sardim after the War of Independence and the airlift of Yemenites and Ethiopians 40 years apart, nothing really compares to the aliyah of Russian Jews. With the rise of communism in 1917, and despite the prominent roles Jews played in the revolution, Jews suffered tremendously under communism, both physically and spiritually, with Torah study, for example, banned for decades. The Soviets did briefly establish a Jewish autonomous province, Birobidzhan, in its Asian territories in 1928. Birobidzhan was settled by about 35,000 Jews. The spoken language there was Yiddish, even street signs were in Yiddish, but it didn't last. Many Soviet Jews clung to their identity, usually because they were persecuted as Jews. They knew they were Jews because of what it said on the passport, and they too became more assertive after the Six-Day War. The rights of Jews to emigrate from the Soviet Union became an international cause and a weapon in the Cold War. When communism fell in 1989 and thereafter the Soviet Union crumbled, Jews came to Israel, almost 1 million in number. in the 1990s, with all their talents and, of course, the problem that many, perhaps as many as 300,000 of them, were not really Jews, a problem that's not yet been resolved. One far-reaching development of the 20th century was the standardization of women's Jewish education, first with the Beis Yaakov movement in Poland under the leadership of Sarah Schneer, all in recognition of the fact that girls were then receiving a secular education and would suffer without a Jewish education. But some perspective is needed before we go too much off the deep end. It's not as if girls were historically deprived of a formal Jewish education. There was no formal Jewish education for boys either. Most boys were educated in cheders until they were 8 or 9 years old, and that was it unless they were somehow gifted. The main impetus was the requirement of universal education that was sweeping through all of Europe, and this became its Jewish form, and therefore was a very natural adaptation to the world around them rather than some revolutionary act. Undoubtedly, in the free West, the prevailing cultural winds always blew into Jewish life and always left its mark on those less committed to Torah. But conversely, the Kiruv and Baal Tshuva movement arose also in the 60s and 70s, spearheaded by the Lubavitcher Rebbe and other Orthodox activists. What a century! Tremendous human progress and human degradation. A century that began with man experimenting with mechanized vehicles, automobiles, and hang gliders, and ending with people bored by space travel because it had become so commonplace. A century that began with and contained remnants of primitive and medieval cruelty and also the most substantial technological progress in history. A century in which, as Chazal predicted about the prelude to the Messianic era, history moved very fast, combining maybe 6 or 7 centuries of history at a more languid pace into a very dynamic century of frenetic activity in which the Jewish people were threatened with extermination and survived to witness the return to Israel, the beginning of the end of the exile, where Torah took advantage of the hospitable shores of America to recreate itself, and then to use modern technology to disseminate its message near and far. The century that began with old threats and ended with new threats that were unimaginable 100 years earlier, and God knows, many people say, we're better off with the threats today than we were with the threats of 100 years ago, but all with the one constant that has animated this long odyssey from the persecutions of Rome, the exile, the sages of the Talmud and the Gaonim of Bavel, from our incredible ability to recreate ourselves after encountering ferocious cruelty in place after place and rebuilding Torah and Jewish life in Bavel, in North Africa, in Western, then Eastern Europe, and then America, that has seen the rise in every generation of great people. To each generation what it needs. Reb Sajigon, Rashi and the Rambam, the Mechaber and the Ramo, the Grod of Yisrael Salanter, Rav Kook and Reb Moshe Feinstein, the one constant that we have seen, that we must acknowledge, is the Yad Hashem that guides us and protects us and nudges us, gives us free choice and free will, but still moves Jewish destiny forward to a time that draws ever nearer, when his ideas will permeate all of mankind in an atmosphere of peace and brotherhood and friendship, when the world, we pray, will finally understand and appreciate the role of Israel. Bayomahu Yashem Echod, Ushmo Echod, Vimheira Biyameinu Amen. I want to thank you all for your participation.
Which two Kohanim?